You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Advances in Anti-Angiogenic Treatment Strategies in the Treatment of Advanced Gastroesophageal Junction and Gastric Cancers. I'm Dr. Richard Dunn, and I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Haesong Park from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. In this podcast, we will discuss clinical trial findings regarding anti-angiogenic treatment for advanced or metastatic gastric and gastroesophageal junction cancers. Welcome, Dr. Park. I'm really looking forward to getting your insight on recent advances in the treatment of gastroesophageal cancer. When describing the treatment landscape for advanced gastroesophageal cancer, I always say that it is a real exciting time to be a researcher and clinician. In just a few years, we went from only having triplet, doublet, or single-agent chemo regimens to having multiple targeted therapies and antibodies to complement our armamentarium. Before we move on to the first question, I'd like to give Dr. Park the opportunity to introduce herself and tell us a little bit about her practice.
Hi, Dr. Dunn. It's very nice to meet you, and I'm very happy to be here. Thank you very much for having me today. I am a gastrointestinal medical oncologist at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. My clinical focus is treating patients with gastric and gastroesophageal junction cancers. And I'm a clinical investigator with research focus in developing novel therapeutics in patients with advanced cancers.
In your opinion, what have been the most important recent advances in the treatment of advanced gastric cancer?
I absolutely agree with you, Dr. Dunn, that it's very exciting time to be a clinician and clinical investigator these days with focus in upper GI cancers. Over the past few years, PD-1, Claudin-18.2, and FGFR targeted therapies have all emerged as a potential new standard therapy in the first line treatment of HER2-negative advanced gastric and esophageal cancers. Most recently, there were results from two large phase 3 studies, the GLOW and SPOTLIGHT studies. They reported clinically meaningful benefits in progression-free survival and overall survival with Claudin-18.2 targeted therapies when they're combined with standard chemotherapy, either FOLFOX or CAPOX. And then a little before that, we had results from the phase 2 portion of the FIGHT trial that established bemarituzumab, that was the FGFR2B targeted monoclonal antibody in combination with FOLFOX chemotherapy. That one also showed promising survival benefit in FGFR2B overexpressing tumors. And then a little before that, PD-1 targeted therapy really now has become the new standard. So combining nivolumab and pembrolizumab with chemotherapy such as FOLFOX or CAPOX, that's really the new worst standard therapy. So these have all been reported in the past 3 years or so. So it's definitely very exciting times. And in HER2-positive disease, use of pembrolizumab in combination with trastuzumab, the HER2-targeted monoclonal antibody, and combination with chemotherapy in the first line has now become the new standard, also again in the past couple years. And then there was approval of trastuzumab deruxtecan, a HER2-targeted antibody-drug conjugate in the second line treatment of these HER2-positive cancers after progression on a trastuzumab-based therapy, also very relatively recent update. And that was an exciting update since several HER2-targeted therapies beyond trastuzumab in gastric and esophageal cancers really haven't been very successful. So since trastuzumab was first approved back in 2001, it's been more than a decade since we have a new HER2-targeted therapy. So I would say these are the most exciting recent advances in the treatment of advanced gastric cancers.
Now we have several new first-line treatment options for patients, both with HER2 positive gastroesophageal cancer and HER2 negative gastroesophageal cancer. So as you described, the integration of IO with chemotherapy and the introduction of targeted therapies for CLDN18.2 or FGFR2 overexpressing tumors. Thinking about the advances in first line and what that might do downstream, if we think about standard second line regimens, they were approved or tested in an era where we were only using chemotherapy or chemotherapy with trastuzumab. Now we have newer options in the first line, but other than the introduction of trastuzumab deruxtecan, we have very similar options in second line and later treatment of gastroesophageal cancer. So in that context, do the recent advances in first line therapy impact what options we may have in the second line and how you sequence therapies?
I think short answer to that is currently, no, we don't have enough evidence that actually changes anything in the second line setting. But I'm really hoping in the future, we will see smarter strategy to prioritize and take advantage of these biomarkers in the second line setting as well. As you mentioned, the best evidence that we have in the second line setting is the RAINBOW study that combined ramucirumab and paclitaxel. It showed that it was better than just using paclitaxel in that setting. So that's really our best standard second line therapy after progression on first line chemotherapy. And again, this is chemotherapy, FOLFOX therapy, not necessarily the incorporation of all these novel biomarker directed therapies. And then there are some smaller trials that also show combining ramucirumab with irinotecan based chemotherapy can be beneficial in second line setting as well. So also after second line after progression on the FOLFOX-based chemotherapy. So the rapid advances in the first line treatment is very much exciting. But I think we now have more questions on how to really best strategize treatments in the second line setting. And we need to build up that evidence now.
So you alluded to the GLOW and SPOTLIGHT studies, which look at the use of zolbetuximab, which is not FDA approved, although it is going through review currently, of using zolbetuximab with chemo in CLDN18.2 expressing gastroesophageal cancers. Now, thinking to the future, this is somewhat hypothetical, but if you're using a CLDN targeted agent with chemotherapy in the first line, and you're not using IO in the first line, immunotherapy in the first line, will this potentially change your second line treatment strategy in a HER2 negative patient? Or really, until there's better evidence, are you still sticking at using paclitaxel and ramucirumab in the second line in these patients?
I think that's a very difficult question that I don't think I have a very clear answer to. And it's definitely very complicated. And again, I think the best evidence is using ramucirumab paclitaxel. And this is where we really have to have more clinical trials investigating if there's a better option at this point. And if you think about these biomarkers, the CLDN18.2 is positive in about 35-40%, according to the data that they had from both GLOW and SPOTLIGHT trials. PD-L1 is positive, and by positive, I mean any CPS positive, somewhere around 30-50% times. And then there's HER2 that's positive roughly about 20% of times. FGFR2, maybe about 30%. And then there are a small proportion where there's MMR deficiency or MSI high disease. So the first line biomarkers are extremely complicated. And I know these are rough estimates, but and also we really don't know whether these biomarkers change with treatment. And if they do change, to what degree do they change? Is there a co-expression of these biomarkers? And do we know which one's more important? There are a lot of things that have not been looked at in these biomarkers. And I think some of these are going to be clinically relevant in terms of making the second line treatment decision, but really in order to make the best treatment decisions in this setting, I really think we need to learn more about the prevalence, their changes over the course of treatment. We really need to learn more about these before we jump into changing practice, I think. And ideally, I would really like to know why the resistance occurs in the first line setting with each of these targeted therapies. Is it from the targeted therapy? Is it because of the chemotherapy portion? I would really like to learn more about that. And it would also be really nice to be able to design a clinical trial to evaluate these subsequent therapy strategies for each biomarker directed therapies. Although I know it may be practically extremely challenging.
So I know that you had said that the newer first line options don't necessarily change what types of treatments you're using in the second line until there's newer evidence. But from a practical sense, does having more and better options in the first line impact, you know, how many patients you think are eligible for second and third line treatment? Having multiple options, does it change, you know, your approach of, you know, thinking about making a change sooner if there's no response? With the development of better therapies, have you seen this kind of bear out in your practice when you're treating the refractory patient in the second or third line?
I think we are seeing some of that for sure. And with access to the newer agents that are also targeting these, you know, CLDN18.2 or FGFR, I've definitely seen the trend where we try to at least have patients have exposure to these newer agents that have the targeted component, assuming that they have the right tumor type, and trying to have patients experience these therapies before it's too late.
Kind of a more specific question, but in your HER2 positive patients in the second line, how are you choosing, because you have multiple options. So HER2 positive patient progresses on first line chemotherapy, trastuzumab and pembrolizumab, and you have options to either give trastuzumab deruxtecan or paclitaxel and ramucirumab in the second line, both FDA approved. Now there is a trial, which I think is DESTINY-Gastric04, that is looking at these two head to head. But currently, before that data comes out, how are you making decisions for your patients in the second line with both options available?
Also a great question. So if we have appropriate clinical trial that are utilizing other HER2-directed strategies, we try to put those patients on those clinical trials first before putting them on standard of care, either trastuzumab deruxtecan or ramucirumab paclitaxel. Another approach that we have sort of taken is try to re-biopsy at the time of disease progression and see if it still makes sense to use HER2-directed therapy in this population. And if the patient has HER2-negative disease at that time, then we're more inclined to use ramucirumab paclitaxel. If they have still HER2 strongly positive disease, perhaps use trastuzumab deruxtecan. And also some of it depends on what kind of residual side effects that they're experiencing from the previous chemo.
On that question of repeating the biopsy, I think this is a great question. I've talked to a number of folks who have kind of different approaches. Could you tell us or give us an estimate of how many of your HER2 positive patients you're sending for repeat tissue biopsy? and how many you're sending a liquid biopsy on, and how many are you doing both?
I think we're increasingly sending the liquid biopsy more than actually repeating the tissue biopsy. And personally, in my practice, it used to be maybe half and half. Now it's more 30% tissue biopsy, 70% liquid. And sometimes just because we don't like waiting for the biopsies, we send liquid biopsies at the same time. So maybe that's 10-15% of times.
So that's great information. So, you know, to summarize, you know, when you have two valid options, they haven't been compared head to head yet, that study's ongoing, potentially understanding whether the cancer is still HER2 positive or HER2 positive clones were killed by the initial targeted treatment is very helpful at decision making in second line. My last question is, we're using IO in the first line, using paclitaxel and ramucirumab in the second line. What is the potential role or any role in combining VEGF-targeted therapies with immunotherapy in gastroesophageal cancer? We've seen this strategy be successful in other tumor types, particularly from our world in gastrointestinal oncology, seeing that in hepatocellular carcinoma with atezolizumab and bevacizumab, but also it has been done for quite a bit in renal cell cancer. So I know there are some studies that are ongoing, some preliminary data that has been released. I wonder if you can talk about the role of combining these two strategies and any studies that you might be excited about.
Yeah, also a very exciting area right now. I think it makes a whole lot of sense combining the angiogenesis targeted therapy with the immune checkpoint inhibitor, because the vascular endothelial growth factor, it has a lot of immune suppressive effects. It modulates your tumor microenvironment so that the immune checkpoint inhibitors don't work as well. So the combining that, the VEGF-targeted therapy with checkpoint inhibitors, it just makes sense preclinically. And I think we do have several, at least early efficacy signals in gastroesophageal cancer that this may actually work. There was I believe this was in first and second line setting in combination with lenvatinib and pembrolizumab, which showed great response rates in a relatively small study. And then there were studies with regorafenib and nivolumab in more advanced settings, also seems to be fairly promising in terms of response rates. And there is the LEAP trial, the LEAP 14 and 15 trials that are evaluating the lenvatinib combination with the pembrolizumab and chemotherapy, and then comparing it to the standard chemotherapy. I would really like to see what that shows in the first line setting. As you know, the ramucirumab approach or bevacizumab or any VEGF targeted approach in first line setting for gastric esophageal cancer so far hasn't been successful, and we just combined it with chemotherapy. So having the immune checkpoint inhibitor in addition to chemotherapy and VEGF targeted therapy on top of that, I hope that really moves that needle better. Now it's going to be more complicated in the first line setting in terms of choosing what the best treatment option would be.
That's a great point. I mean, you referenced the Avogast, and I believe it was Rainfall studies, where combining VEGF with chemotherapy in the first line were ultimately unsuccessful. So be very excited to see the results of LEAP 15, which instead of using an antibody is using tyrosine kinase inhibitor with lenvatinib. And hopefully we will have another and more efficacious option for the first line treatment of gastroesophageal junction and gastric cancers. And I think it's too early to understand or know what that will do downstream to second line and later strategies. However, you know, patients having better responses, living longer, preserve functional status, my hope is that it translates into more patients being candidates for, you know, second, third line therapy as we continue to search for more treatment options. So I want to thank you so much. That's all the time we have today. I want to thank Dr. Park for sharing her insights and experience with us regarding clinical trials for anti-angiogenic treatment strategies and first and second line treatment options in advanced gastric cancer. And thank you for joining us. We hope you'll listen to another episode of this series. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And I want to give a special thank you to our supporter, Eli Lilly, who provided an educational grant for this activity. Take care.